de la revolución del mundo.
Justice by any means necessary.
This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
Perfect. Here we go. This panel titled An Independent Guahan, Indigenous Resistance and Self-Determination in the Face of U.S. Imperialism. My name is Nathan Samayo. I use any pronouns, and just want to say thank you for coming. I'm representing DSA, so the Democratic Socialists of America International Committee, specifically with the Guahan and Oceania Working Group. And before we get started, I just want to give a special thanks to our guest today, zooming in from Guahan, and I believe it's 1 a.m. over there, so we really appreciate y'all's time. And just personally, thank you to Dr. McGett and Naik for the tireless organizing and working that they do on behalf of an independent Guahan. And among that, they really bring people into the vision of independence and teach people along the way. So I just want to say thank you for all that y'all do, and thank you for being our teachers as well today and, you know, forever moving forward. So thank you for joining us, and I'll pass this on to Aaron.
Hey, half a day. Na'an Husi Aaron King Akur. Hello, my name is Aaron King Akur. I will also be facilitating this session today. I'm here as a member of the Democratic Socialists of America International Committee and an organizer with the Guam Working Group. Just to introduce this session, Guahan, or Guam, is located in the Pacific with a population of little more than 170,000. It is frequently neglected in discussions about U.S. imperialism and decolonization. Despite this, the Chamorro people have resisted Western imperialism since Spanish colonization over 400 years ago. Today, as an unincorporated territory of the U.S., the island is exploited by the military as the tip of the spear in ongoing posturing with China. This panel will focus on the growing self-determination movement on Guahan, driven by the urgent need to protect the island's cultural heritage and fragile ecosystem from catastrophic damage wrought by U.S. imperialism. And I'm very excited and honored to introduce our two panelists today, Michael Lujan Bavacqua and Maneka Flores, calling in from Guahan on 1 a.m., at 1 a.m., so thank you for joining us at this time. Michael Lujan Bavacqua taught Guam history and Chamorro language at the University of Guam for 10 years. He also runs a weekly podcast called Finatsu, and currently works as a curator for the Guam Museum. With his brother Jack, they run a creative company called the Guam Bus that publishes Chamorro language books, comics, and learning materials. He is a co-chair for the Political Status Education Outreach Group, Independent Guahan, and a member of Guam's Commission on Decolonization. And Maneka Naik Flores is a queer Chamorro artist and activist from Guahan. Naik is the lead organizer of Protehi Lateksan Save Ratidian, a direct action group dedicated to the protection of natural and cultural resources in all sites identified for DOT live fire training on Guam. Naik is also a core member of Marianas for Palestine and an independent Guahan. And I will pass it over to Maget first to give us some historical context on Guahan. So please take it away, Maget.
Sidus Masi. I don't know if I'm able to share, because I do have some slides, just with some images, just to help give some context. So, Guahan, a brief history of life at the tip of America's spear. Sidus Masi. Sidus Masinu Hamzu Torus. Thank you to all of you, Inanusi Michael Luhan Bavakwa, Familia and Kabesa and Bitut Gin and Guahan. Thank you to all of you. My name is Michael Luhan Bavakwa. I appreciate the chance to talk to you a little bit about history of Guam. You know, what is it to live at a place that the U.S. military has called the tip of its spear? And so, first off, as we heard a little bit, Guam in the Western Pacific part of the Marianas. And so Guam is an island, 212 square miles, about 170,000 people live on Guam. It is in the Western Pacific on the edge of Asia, thousands of miles away from Hawaii, even further away from the continental United States, 9,000 miles away from Washington, D.C., where a lot of military strategic decisions are made by the United States. And so these types of maps are important to help give you perspective about centers of power for the United States and just how far away they are for those of us in Guam, in the Marianas, especially as you learn the history of Guam. And so the history of Guam and the Chamorro people, the indigenous people of Guam, goes back thousands of years. But because this is a brief history, we're going to focus in just on the last 120 years or so. And so these are pictures, June 1898. This is when the United States takes Guam from the Spanish, which had colonized the island for more than 200 years. In the Spanish-American War, Guam becomes an American colony. And so the United States comes into Guam at that time. It takes a number of other territories, and there's a lot of rhetoric about American greatness, manifest destiny, and so on, that America will spread things like democracy. It'll spread fantastic and wonderful things that will improve the world, improve the lives of the people that it is spreading all this great stuff to. But the reality around the world and the reality in Guam, of course, is very different. In truth, the reality is that colonialism is brought to Guam. Colonialism felt by the Chamorro people in a variety of different ways. So racial segregation is brought into Guam. Language suppression. One of the things that the Chamorro people experience is, of course, the fact that their language is prohibited in the school system. Young children are punished. Have to pay fines if they even speak a word in their own native language. And so the U.S. military and Guam at this time is, even though the American flag flies over the island and sort of the greatness of the principles of the United States are preached on the island is governed by a U.S. Navy government. So U.S. Navy officers rule over a civilian population, and the United States. And so whatever Chamorro's experience about the United States is clearly not the best of the United States. They experience a militarized sort of authoritarian regime, which improves the island in some ways, but definitely doesn't improve the island in other ways. The United States controls the island for several decades before World War II, before the strategic interests of the United States clash with the strategic interests of the United States, of the Japanese, which had taken the surrounding islands in Micronesia in World War I. And this led to conflict in the region with the Chamorro people in Guam sort of becoming the victims. And so the Japanese invaded, bombed Guam just a few hours after Pearl Harbor was bombed by the Japanese, and within 2 days, the Japanese had invaded Guam, and they occupied the island for about 32 months. And the Chamorro people were caught between a clash between empires, where the Japanese prohibited everything that represented the United States, confiscating American money, prohibiting the English language, confiscating American English language newspapers. And the Chamorro people were basically, if they had any connections to the United States, were brutalized or victimized for that. And the Chamorro people hoped that the United States would return even though the United States had treated the Chamorro people in particularly racist and paternalistic ways, there was still a desire for them to return because the Japanese were so brutal. The United States did come back, destroying most of the structures on the island with an intense bombing campaign that lasted for almost 2 weeks, and then eventually did kick out the Japanese in 1944. And when they did return...
Recording in progress.
When they did return, the Chamorro people thought that things would be different. The Chamorro people had suffered. They had sacrificed. By the end of the war, the Japanese had massacred hundreds of Chamorros around the island because of their connections to the United States. And so the Chamorro people thought that the United States would recognize this and they would not treat them in the racist, paternalistic, discriminatory ways that they had treated them before the war. And so there was hope that the post-war years would be different. This was not necessarily the case. The United States had a very small presence in Guam before World War II. The island was considered to be a sleepy base that had been primarily a coaling station, allowing ships to refill with coal as they crossed the Pacific. After World War II, Guam became an integral piece in the larger strategic plan for the United States in terms of creating the Pacific as an American lake, an important buffer zone. And Guam was important not just as a buffer like the rest of the Pacific, but Guam would be used to project force. So Guam would be built up with massively to project force against American enemies in Asia. And so because of this, the presence of American military on Guam prior to World War II was pretty small. After the war, the United States intended to make Guam into Fortress Guam, a massive military base, and they started to take land at a ravenous rate with that intention in mind. And at first, the Chamorro people, because the war was still being prosecuted against the Japanese, were very willing to give up their land, assuming that once the war was over, they would get the land back. But to help the Americans to fight the Japanese, of course, you can take my land if you need it for a runway, if you need it for a base, whatever you need it for, please defeat the Japanese. But after the war was over and the Japanese had surrendered, the United States took even more land from the Chamorro people. And of an island of 21,000 people, more than 1,000 families lost their land. And so after 3 years after the war was over, beautiful beach areas such as Tuman Bay here, Chamorro families were being evicted to simply create recreational places where U.S. military troops could simply relax on beaches. And so this is a picture, a tragically iconic picture of an elderly Chamorro woman who was receiving a check after she and her family have been evicted from their land, basically in the military vice admiral here saying, look at the compensation that she and other Chamorros are receiving isn't military grand for how they are treating the people. And so this was frustrating and upsetting for Chamorros after they had sacrificed, died, and suffered for the United States, after they had stayed loyal in the face of Japanese brutality, and America was now taking land left and right from the people, even though the war was over, bulldozing farmlands, building Quonset huts on them, pushing people off their land to build golf courses. And so there was debates. What do you do? What can you do against the greatest military, the greatest power in the world at that time? And so the feeling was that the only thing that you could do is insist that you become part of the family. And so Carlos Taitano, who was an elected leader into the advisory Guam Congress at that time, pushed for citizenship, arguing we can't ask for anything from the United States because we're not part of them. Let's become citizens, and then we can insist that they treat us with respect. Then we can demand rights. The Guam Congress, an advisory Congress at that time, voted to protest, walk out of session, and refuse to meet until they were given citizenship, given basic rights. Their protest, which was largely symbolic, was picked up by newspapers across the United States, some even calling it the Guam's Boston Tea Party. And newspapers across the United States drew attention to the fact that these people who had suffered and died for the United States and their loyalty, that the U.S. Navy was taking their land and then treating them so badly, taking acres and acres of land and giving them pennies and dollars for that land. And so all of this attention led to the passage of the Organic Act. And the Organic Act, here's Harry S. Truman signing it, Carlos Titano here, looking very dapper, was the only Chamorro present, and he just happened to be there attending Georgetown University. He was not necessarily invited to be there. And so the Organic Act is something which creates citizenship for the Chamorro people at that time, and then it also allowed for birthright citizenship for those born on Guam after 1950. It created a civilian government for Guam, but prior to this, it was a military government on Guam. It allowed for a civilian governor to be appointed by the president. It was eventually amended so that the people on Guam after 1970, that we finally get to elect a governor. It allows for a locally elected legislature, a local judiciary, and it allows for certain parts of the U.S. Constitution to apply to Guam. But the Organic Act is not a local constitution. It is a federal law that allows, that basically acts as a constitution or a pseudo-constitution for the island. But it is not something that comes from the people. This was an improvement, but an improvement with limitations. As the late governor of Guam, Ricky Berdalio, said, it was in truth a sad day for the people of Guam when the Organic Act was signed. The Organic Act is not designed to enhance the dignity of the indigenous people. It was designed to enhance the colonial authority of the United States. And so we should talk more about what this colonial authority of the United States means. Because what does it mean to be a colony in today's world, especially after citizenship has been bestowed upon the Chamorro people, and that Guam is not a colony in the same vein of the colonies of yore? What does it mean? And so Guam is, within the United States, referred to as an organized unincorporated territory. And what this means in some basic practical terms is that the people in Guam are a territory of the United States. This means that Guam is a possession of the United States. The island is a possession of the United States. This means that it is not an equal part of the United States. It is not a full part of the United States. People on the island may be citizens of the United States, they may be nationals, they may be whatever, but the island itself is not a full and equal part, which means that the rights of those who live there can be infringed upon because of its status as a unincorporated territory. People there are unable to vote for president of the United States. They have no electoral college votes. There is no voting representation in the U.S. Congress. There is just a non-voting delegate. All federal laws apply to Guam, just like they apply to other U.S. territories, unless there is a expressed exemption for them. And despite the fact that Guam is democratically excluded from the United States, there are clear democratic deficiencies, that Guam does not get to participate in whatever democracy the United States has. This does not mean that Guam gets to have exemptions on its own. So Guam does not get to pass laws that are unconstitutional or that conflict with federal law or that ignore federal law. Guam, as a territory, is expected to follow the U.S. Constitution, follow federal laws. And there have been many cases where local laws have been passed, especially in the name of the indigenous people or in terms of local sovereignty, which then get overturned by federal courts. But this is just kind of a snapshot of an unincorporated territory of the United States. But within a, you know, a more international framework, Guam is what's called a non-self-governing territory per the United Nations. And this is important because within the United States, to be unincorporated refers to your relationship to the United States, whether you are incorporated or not. But per the United Nations, the issue is, do you self-govern? Are you sufficiently self-governing, or are there deficiencies that need to be addressed? And so this is a much better way to kind of term to define this. And so when we look at it this way, we can see that Guam has no seat at the United Nations. Guam is unable to participate in most international or regional forums. Guam is not able to enter into treaties or agreements with neighboring islands or neighboring countries. And even though, as we're going to learn, as we're going to talk about, the United States military has a massive presence in Guam and huge strategic interests in Guam, Guam has no authority over U.S. military activities in Guam's lands, Guam's waters, or Guam's air. And so this is truly what it means to be non-self-governing. With these two pages, these two slides combined, you can see that Guam is clearly non-self-governing. Sometimes people argue, oh, but you're attached to the United States. You know, it's such a rich country. You're so lucky. You're clearly not suffering. But if the question is, are you self-governing? If so much of your land is controlled by the U.S. military, and you neither have the ability to affect policy at the federal level or the ability locally to pass laws that can affect what that military does, can you call yourself self-governing if the mechanisms of power locally or nationally or internationally, that you are excluded from all of those mechanisms of power? Then does it matter if you have an olive garden on your island? Does it matter? And so I've gone through two things, but the last thing that I want to mention here is Guahan Tanuitsamur. This is an image of the license plate in Guam, and you can see that there is this tension on what is Guam. Guam, USA on the top, and on the bottom, Tanuitsamuru, which means land of the Chamorros. Guam has been the home of the Chamorro people for close to 4,000 years. And so the Chamorro people, we are the first people, as far as we know, to settle the Pacific Islands. Some of the earliest people to travel and migrate into the Pacific. And so our claim to these islands is older sort of than the earliest figments of fantasies of the United States imaginable. And so this is also something that's important to remember in these conversations, is that the parameters of our discussion, the limits of our imagination, should not be defined by unincorporated, incorporated status debates. That we as a people go beyond, we go before that, we must persist even after that. But the reality of the Chamorro people is long complicated by the fact that we are the tip of America's spear. What does it mean to be the tip of America's spear? 212 square miles. But as you can see here, the green versus the white. All of the white, these are U.S. military facilities. In the northern part of Guam, you have Air Force bases. In the middle, you have Army bases. In the south, you have Navy bases. And now you also have Marine Corps bases that have been added in. And as you can see from this image here, there are not only bases that take up one third of Guam's 212 square miles, but that Guam every 2 years hosts massive war games in which not just the United States, but other countries are invited to bring their own hardware, their own personnel, their own planes, their own ships, their own submarines into the waters and the skies and the lands of Guam to participate in drills and exercises and so on. And so Guam, as not just Guam, but the Marianas and this entire region, has also been referred to as the military's playground, the military's largest playground, because the ocean around us is one of their most, the biggest sort of military testing and training areas in the world. And so the last thing that I want to focus on is sort of why Guam matters in all of this. Why is it that an island which is just 212 square miles, why is it valuable to the United States? Why has the United States put tens of billions of dollars into Guam? And one of the things that you'll find, as generations of military commanders of the United States have gone on the record to discuss, is the idea of strategic flexibility. And they will discuss this in both sort of quiet part loud, loud part quiet ways. One, so for example, William Fallon was a former PATCOM commander, and he was asked why Guam is important, why Guam matters. And in 2006, he gave a reason. He said, Guam is important, simply you just need to look at a map. And so what that means is that Guam's value to the United States is that you just look at where Guam is. And so when asked about what William Fallon meant, when he said that the Joint Guam Program Office, which was an office which was meant to sell the military buildup, the military increases to Guam, basically said a ship traveling from San Diego to get to Taiwan takes this long, but from Guam it only takes this long. And so it's a numbers game. If you put your hardware in Guam, and if your targets are in Asia, Guam matters because it's there. And what America's interested in, it's over there. Location, location, location. But the quiet part, which you have to look at the edges of the discourse, is always the political ambiguity of Guam, that it is of value as well. And it's always there, it's always discussed, but it's not as prominent, but it's still crucial. And so when Fallon was asked why Guam is important, he also said Guam is American territory. And its value is that it does not have the political restrictions that you find in a place like South Korea, which could impede U.S. military moves in an emergency. And just 13 years before him, a U.S. Air Force commander had reinforced this point when asked by an anthropologist about sort of what is Guam's value, you know, what is Guam to the United States, what its value. And he had said, well, Guam's value is that if you are talking about military in California, California or states have needs. They can request this, they can request that. But if Guam says, I want to do this, Guam is like this cup. If Guam expresses a wish, the answer will be, you belong to me, and I can do with you as best I please. And so the value of Guam is that Guam is not an independent country. Guam is where there is a treaty, a status of forces agreement. Neither is Guam a state in which there are state senators, in which there are congresspeople who can vote, who have political power in Washington, D.C. Guam is a strategically located territory on the edge of Asia, which has no political power, which means if you dump military hardware into it, you can use it with impunity, you can train there, and you can put whatever you want there, and there's less restrictions to use it. And so this is life at the tip of the spear. This was a drawing done by my brother Jack, sort of after years of listening to me talk about all of these issues. He put two of my older children, Sumahi and Ekli'i, standing on the tip of a spear with the flags of sort of the countries that surround us with their strategic interests. And so one of the things that, and I'm sure that Moneko will talk about this, one of the things that, just as I close this, that all of these issues has brought about in Guam is making this connection between our lack of power and our lack of ability to do anything about these military threats, sort of our military value and so on, is that it is something that people connect to our lack of political power, our lack of sovereignty. And so in 2019, prior to the COVID pandemic, the largest political demonstration around Guam's political status and in support of Guam's decolonization took place. The Funoge March for Chamorro Self-Determination, 2,000 people plus marched in favor of changing Guam's political status, to change it from something other than being a territory. And this march was also undertaken in the support of the Chamorro people and their right to self-determine, their right that they should be supported in expressing what they want for their future. And so this is sort of the reality, is that people, when living in this island in which there's these constant discussions of war, these rumors of war, these threats of war, it is very natural to feel helpless and powerless, and then natural then to want to seek some type of change in which we can assert some sovereignty over these fundamental questions of our safety and our security as an island. And so thank you for listening to me, and thank you for listening to me as I share some of this history from Guam and what it means to live on the tip of America's spear.
Cizos Mossy Maguet. I'm not sure, do I just jump into it, guys? Do I just...
Yeah, feel free to just jump into it.
And I don't know if I'm also... Oh, I can share a screen. Okay, but I'll do that in a second. Miguel did such a great job positioning us. Can I just also do a time check? How are we on time?
Sure.
And our overall...
I have another hour.
You have another hour? Oh, okay, great. Okay, cool.
Thank you, Nick. Yeah, we have about an hour and... we're hoping to have about 40 to 45 minutes of discussion, so 15, 20-ish minutes, if that's okay.
Nice. Yeah.
Thank you, Nate.
Thank you. Just wanted to check in. Yeah, Miguel did such an amazing job really positioning us as positioning Guam as a colony, a military colony of the United States. And, you know, all the ways that U.S. imperialism, patriarchy, white supremacy are maintained through the militarization of the Marianas, of the Pacific. We really got to think about all the different kinds of colonization we've experienced, right? From economic to cultural, as well as political, to impacting the ways we collect food and medicines, the way, we exchange, have daily exchange, ceremony, but also our economic sovereignty, our ecological sovereignty, and then also building Guam up as a place of force projection, having that history behind it. And that's really where we're at today, the hypermilitarization of our island. We're looking at a lot of, destruction, contamination, desecration of sacred areas, all of this really compounded on now multiple generations of this kind of violence to the land happening over and over again since World War II. And so, and poverty, of course, is a real issue that we continue to struggle with as a result of the land taking that Miguel was talking about. 30% of the island, they'll say 28 to 29%, but we'll round it up to 30% of the island is occupied by the United States military, but over 40,000 acres of land. And I myself come from families that have lost land in the north of Guam, at Taragi Beach, actually, which is contained within the Air Force base. And so we have to ask permission. We get a property pass every year so that we can go to this land called Annapsin, which is landlocked between the area known as Letekzin and Taragi Beach, which is part of the Air Force base. So it's like sandwiched between two federally occupied properties, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife occupied area of Letekzin and Taragi Beach, the occupied area of the Air Force base. And so these areas are very precious areas. These are areas where with endangered species, with ancestral burials, these are areas that are right over our sole source aquifer that provides our island, you know, 85 to 90% of our fresh drinking water. Right now, we're just dealing with the news that water in the south, the cost to deliver water in the south is going to go up multiple times because the Navy, which uses a reservoir in the south, wants to increase its sale, increase the price of water to deliver. They call it Navy water, to deliver our water back to us. And so, there's just so much happening. Miget kind of helped, you know, set up the history. And so now I guess I'm going to go to what's happening now. And so this is, you know, unfortunately, I'm not going to have any sweeping, inspirational, beautiful, funny anecdotes. We're bringing a lot of, you know, sad, difficult things to talk about over and over again. And of course, how they're connected to the atrocities, the genocides, the occupations happening around the world. The things that happen here, the destruction we're witnessing in real time for the expansion of U.S. imperialism and militarization is directly linked to the genocide happening in Palestine and the genocide happening in Sudan and Congo and everywhere around the world. It's kind of hard to figure out where to start, but I guess, let's see, I did want to start here with the kind of picking up where we get left off. This is a map to kind of emphasize the strategic location of Guam to this area. And so now we're also being called, you know, as you can see, we're a site for U.S. force projection in the region, but it's also, as Miguel calls, I mentioned, the tip of the spear. We take no pride in being called the tip of the spear. Miguel has said before, the tip of the spear is the first bloodied and lost in battle. But what we're also called now is a first strike community. So should the region enter into conflict, Guam, the Philippines, and Okinawa, Hawaii, even, Guam, we will be part of the first strike communities. And, as Miguel said, we don't have full protection of the Constitution. You know, we don't have, we have U.S. passports, but we don't vote for the president. We only have a non-voting delegate in Congress. We don't have qualify for some of the programs, most importantly, we are just. I'm sorry. It's 1 o'clock in the morning. It's 1:39 in the morning. Also here in Guam, I'm a little delirious. We're calling from the future. It's a Monday morning. We're calling from the future. It's a lot. It's a lot to show up today because poverty also is such a massive problem here, as it is in any colonial any community directly impacted by U.S. bases and colonization. You know, any Native communities of color, enlistment is quite high. Guam and Micronesia is also known as a recruiter's paradise. Miguel was talking about how it's like a military playground, but also a recruiter's paradise because, for a lot of folks out here, it's probably their first ticket out for educational professional opportunities. It's called a recruiter's paradise because of the signing bonuses that recruiters get and the high numbers of young islanders they get. So there's also been a mass exodus here. with the increased militarization, of course, we are being built up to be a site for conflict again, a bigger target for where we've always been a target because of our location. But now we're looking also at the construction of the of a missile defense system. And I'm going to go ahead and queue up some other slides here. I'm just going to talk through these slides. So this is our Cancel RENPEC solidarity protest that we had in front of a Joint Region Medianas in Nimitzel. And then we have a banner back there, No War Games and the Genocide. These are the ones we did for Valiant Shield and Cope North. So these are two of the big military exercises, the war games that Miguel was talking about. Valiant Shield always leads up to RIMPAC. These are the Rim of the Pacific exercises in Hawaii. These are the biggest war games in the Pacific. They cause they burn an incredible amount of fossil fuel. They kill endangered species. They cause a lot of contamination. And violent crimes increase, definitely impacting numbers for missing and murdered Indigenous women, trans and two-spirit relatives, and other things, traffic, drunk driving, all of these things, accidents, all of these things increase around these exercises. So these are two protests in front of the Air Force base. Also demanding a first ceasefire now, because all of these things, are connected. And just gonna stop there for a second as I wanted to, here we go. Sorry guys, a little technical difficulty. Of course it happens when you are in a Zoom on a live. Okay, so here we go. Let's share these. Okay. So as I mentioned earlier, Guam is going to receive a 360-degree missile defense system. They're looking at 20 sites around the island. It started over at the beginning. Let me get back to that map. And so this missile defense system is being built by Lockheed Martin. They're getting, maybe $500 million contract to develop this missile defense system. They already are, responsible for the other, the THAAD and the Aegis Ashore that we have here. But so there, there's all of these contractors that have been making a lot of money since October 7th are making money here in Guam for the buildup of the bases and the missile defense system. We're also going to be seeing missile testing starting in December. So this December, we're going to see the first wave of Marines from Okinawa to Guam. They've been reporting about 100 Marines, but we know it's going to be a lot more than that. We're also going to see an increase of more military personnel for the operation of the missile testing and for, of course, the construction of the missile defense systems. We just had two community meetings for the missile testing, and we had protests at both of those community meetings. And then for the missile defense system, there, we did have some protests for that last year during the draft, the initial commenting period. Now the final EIS is supposed to come out. So the draft EIS came out last year. The final EIS is coming out in a few weeks. And this missile testing comment period, this isn't the open detonation and open detonation site in Anderson Air Force Base. This is near Taragi Beach. Our group is also fighting these kinds of issues. We have a long history of military contamination, environmental justice issues, such as the use of Agent Orange, which was just only recently declassified. We were lied to for decades that Agent Orange was used here and that people were exposed to Agent Orange contamination. We do have three contamination sites for open burning, open detonation. We have in the Navy base, the Anderson Air Force Base, and also where the firing range is being built now for the Marine base. Four out of the five ranges are finished. And then here's another way that our islands are definitely connected to what's happening in Palestine. So this is something that was quite disturbing. This was something that our friend, Dr. Issa Areola from our Commonwealth 670 discovered. And this is part of our work in Medianus for Palestine, trying to link the ways that we're all connected, all the intersections, you know, from Palestine to the Philippines, to the Marianas, to Puerto Rico, to Hawaii, all the ways that we as occupied, militarized sites of U.S. imperialism and sites of U.S. violence are connected to what's happening in Palestine. And so this really doesn't make sense for Guam. The Iron Dome is for short-range missiles. And for Guam, you know, they're saying that we need this missile defense system for long-range missiles. And so it wouldn't make sense to test Iron Dome here. It was a total waste of money. It definitely impacted the environment. But this is also language that's constantly being used to promote the construction of the missile defense system here. They keep saying things like, oh, you know, it's going to be just like Iron Dome. It's going to be just like how it works in Israel in Iron Dome. And, you know, of course, it's part of the propaganda that that we're just being fed over and over and over again about the, you know, the, I guess, the viability of these. We're actually the test sites, the guinea pigs, not just for Iron Dome, but we will be for this missile defense system, which is not proven technology. The 20 sites will require the clearing of more land. It'll expose more unexploded ordnance. It will definitely impact cultural sites and endangered species. It'll make groundwater more susceptible to contamination. And many other things. This is a horrific graphic from the outreach materials from the Missile Defense Agency when they were out here just last month for their... They call them community meetings, but it's really a joke because they don't actually have formal presentations. There's no town hall discussion so that you can hear other people's questions and be in actual conversation. There's these sort of show and tell poster displays with people talking in these individual conversations, you know, in silos to each other. But this is a horrible graphic where... You know, they want to take these missiles and launch them from Anderson Air Force Base in the north into the water. It's interesting because they don't have any of the islands to the north of Guam in this graphic. And this actually enters the environmental zone for the Northern Marianas. So there's Rota's not there. Luta's not there. Saipan, none of the islands are there. It's terrible. And so, yeah, then another missile would be launched from a ship or a plane. They would collide into each other over the ocean, and all of that debris will be left there. There are no plans for remediation or removal. And also, they are requiring access restrictions, obviously, to the ocean, but also to private properties. Not just the federally occupied properties like Le Texan and, you know, parts of the Air Force Base, but also private lands in Arunau and Anapsin, which are on the other side of Taragi and Le Texan, and then also parts of Jigo. And so these tests can be about, they want to run them twice a year for 10 years for up to 4 days. So that's 8 days a year of possible property access restrictions to these sacred areas. You know, and a lot of these families already have been displaced from the military occupation to other lands. But this is definitely a violation of prior and informed consent, a violation of our indigenous rights. And all of this is being done in a process to fast track this. So this was just done with an environmental assessment and what they called a FONSI, a finding of no significant impacts. And so for every single thing, they kept saying, oh, for air emissions, there's no significant impacts. For cultural resources, there's no significant impacts. For, you know, water contamination, groundwater, there's no significant impacts. For coastal resources, there may be, but no significant impacts. It was just ridiculous. And what they should, what they actually need to do is a full environmental assessment, for instance, of all of those private properties, all of the cultural resources on every single one of those. They need to fast track this missile testing in order to fast track the construction of the missile defense system. And so, this is quite a horrifying graphic here. And so, they've been stacking up these commenting periods. You know, of course, they don't feel, they don't really feel very meaningful. Sometimes it feels like they're just checking off the boxes, to say that they've met the requirements of engaging with the community, informing the community, when in actuality, you know, they're making these decisions and not without really considering community, without really engaging the community in the whole process. But also, we still have to show up. And people have asked us recently, like, what can you do? You know, if they're going to just do it anyway, if the military is just making these decisions without you and they're not listening to you, what can you do? And it's... a reporter actually framed it and said she's going to be nihilistic about the question, which I found it so deeply offensive. And I got so angry because, you know, you should never question indigenous resistance. You should to their own, you know, our indigenous resistance to our own colonization and our own militarization. It is, you should never undermine it. You should never disrespect it. And, it's just another layer of violence when people suggest that it's pointless, that the efforts, of course, are not going to bring any results. And so, you know, that does, of course, lead to the question, right? What can we do also in everyday, in our everyday lives? What can we do to build revolution in our everyday lives? And, you know, one of the questions that we had in coming to this talk, of course, is how does socialism manifest and materialize in our community as a colony, as a colonized people? And when we were having conversations about it before, you know, in preparation for this talk, we were thinking about something we call chinchuli or tsintsuli. Chinchuli is a practice of reciprocity. Redistributing resources. An example is, Dr. Ayan Hattori did this great paper about, you know, when somebody passes away in your family, when her father passed away, and all these people came over to her house with food, immediately started coming over to her mother's house with food, and they started writing a list of who brought what every single night, and it ended up being a beautiful list of dishes that people prepared, and people took turns doing this, and then you would keep this list, and you would redistribute the resources later. And it's the same thing with putti. When someone catches large amount of fish, and then they share it up, they break it up. It's also in other practices like in Egofli'i, you know, really seeing each other, or in Afamalik, making things good, making things right. We've definitely been challenged, you know, the colonial capitalist way of life has been really difficult for us to maintain, especially during the pandemic. We saw really the need to go back to practices of cultivating food, fishing, and then also with the typhoon. We were just hit with a super typhoon last year, Typhoon Mawar, and immediately saw how, you know, that this militarized and federalized response and how disgusting it was and how inadequate it was, you know. And of course, the cultural ways of taking care of your neighbors, checking in with family, helping each other rebuild and clean up afterward, really, really how you share food after a storm, are really tested now. You know, these same connections to each other and to the land have been negatively impacted. Our health has been negatively impacted because of the land taking, of the continued hypermilitarization and contamination of the lands here, the development for tourism and the other extractive industries here. It was also hard after the typhoon to do things like get trucks for construction or for removing debris. A lot of those resources were still being diverted to the base for construction while we were devastated by a typhoon and grieving absolutely grieving the loss of, you know, of homes, of work, of I mean, we have relatives who lost roofs. We have friends whose farms were destroyed. These were devastating losses. The fruiting trees, the avocado, the mango, the iba, they were all so full of fruit right before the storm. And you know, these storms are going to continue to grow stronger. And the military is the world's worst polluter, one of the largest consumers of fossil fuels. So to really be here in this place now, really, you know, in the Pacific, that's dealing with the climate catastrophe in real time, watching the hypermilitarization and destruction of the land in real time, and then also watching a genocide happening every day in real time on our phone, on our phones, right? And recognizing all the ways that these things are connected, and really recognizing that we do need to return to our cultural ways, our indigenous ways, and you know, ways where we can manifest revolution and socialism in our daily lives. You know, people tease us, activists in Guam, like Miguel and myself, they'll say things in the negative, like, "You communists," and we're like, "Okay, yeah, okay. Thanks." Yeah, we you know, but during COVID, some of us participated in seed distribution to try to get people to go back to home gardening, kind of rethinking the ways that people cultivated food in wartime. And then with the super typhoon, a lot of us were, you know, really involved in cleaning up, going to other communities. Some of us were at the cultural center cleaning. Some of us were in a community called Zero Down, which is a community that is a settlement of other indigenous Micronesian Islanders who've come to call Guam home, a very impoverished community. A lot of the island is still, hasn't fully recovered from that typhoon, and people are not talking about it. People are pretending like everything is back to normal. There's still people living in tents, running off their generator, you know, because they haven't been able to rebuild or, you know, just get everything back to the way it was before the typhoon last year. And so, you know, we really also need to look at solidarity with other colonized people, you know, Menyetlu from Puerto Rico, Hawaii, and even the Turtle Island, right, across the United States, and get folks even in the diaspora to come and organize with us, to leverage resources, to leverage, you know, voter influence, because we can't do that from the colony. We do not have a voter impact for president or for Congress. And so, we need our folks in the diaspora to do that, you know, leverage their votes that way. But, you know, also just, it's hard, honestly, sitting here in the colony and having any faith in the electoral process, period, right? Like, we don't really have options. We don't really have options, right? And I don't want to vote. Like, the answer for a lot of us in the colony to decolonize is not to vote for a colonial president, period. Like, that's not... Voting for a colonial president is not going to save us from the climate catastrophe. Voting for a colonial president, you know, is not going to stop nuclear war. And so I think, I think I'll leave it there for now, and then, like, see if we can open it up for questions and maybe some feedback. We've been inundated. We've been inundated with these commenting periods. We've been inundated with news of new contamination, real, like in real time. Like, oh, this is contamination we didn't know about, from PFAS to dieldrin to DDT, or contamination we've known about for a long time, like PCBs, DDT. You know, we have a long history of environmental justice issues here. all because of colonization and militarization. We have Superfund sites at the Ordot dump. We have a PFAS site in Anderson. We have the desecration of our ancestors and lands. Not to mention that the surface danger zone for the firing range is also going to take out 3 miles of ocean. And this is some of the richest fishing area. Our people have been fishing here for thousands of years. 1 year, Guahan was in the Guinness Book of World Records for the biggest fish. And that fish was caught in the waters right in this area that where they're taking 3 miles of land. But it impacts the economic sovereignty of our community. It impacts food sovereignty. It impacts the way this knowledge of this area is being maintained and carried on into future generations. And it's hard to have faith in the bureaucratic process. And so some of us really want to just start over again, have a hard reset here in Guahan. And so, for me, of course, demilitarization is decolonization. I would really like to see also the removal of bases here in Guahan as well. All right. Thank you so much. Sizos Masi.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you again, Nate and Miguet, for joining us. I know Zoom is often like an awkward kind of setup sometimes when we do a conference setting, and I just want y'all to know that there's about 40 to 50 people in this room. So we really appreciate y'all being able to come and give us the history and contemporary geopolitical analysis of Guahan. So we're going to move into a session of questions for about 25 minutes, and then we'll have some wrap-up remarks from... Oh, yeah, everyone's saying, I don't know if y'all can see the folks in our conference. And then we're going to move to 5 minutes of wrap-up, so 25 minutes of discussion. So we'll have folks come up to the mic. We'll be taking stacks, so 3 at a time. So 3 questions/comments, and we're going to limit this to about 1.5 minutes just so that we can get everybody in the room. And then every 3 people will take a second for Miguet and Nate to answer questions. So our comrade in the blue shirt right here, and then comrade over here and comrade right here, we'll start with you 3. And then we'll leave it just about maybe a minute, minute and a half, so we can get to everybody. Thank you.
Hi. Can you hear me on the call? Cool. I just want to say thank you so much for coming out so early in the morning. That is extremely informative and heart-wrenching, and as inspiring as Indigenous resistance has been. Sorry that it has been made necessary. The thing I wanted to ask about was sort of the cultural effects of U.S. imperialism, specifically around queerness, which is an area which in DSA I organize around with a lot, because both the non-acceptance of queerness and the projection of Western queer ontologies have been historically used as weapons of imperialism. I've read a number of articles about how it's been done in Iran, in Somalia, in Pakistan, in Thailand, and all sorts of places that have Indigenous queer ontologies that just don't fit into Western models of it. Is that the case for Guahan? Is that is there queer ontologies in Chamorro history that have been actively suppressed by the U.S.? And how do we keep those traditions alive? How do you manage that?
Thank you.
Hi.
Okay, well, Freywan Pobre was probably the first person to write about Chamorro queerness, but he said that it didn't exist. He's a missionary. Miguel, what year was he? Did he come out again, Freywan Pobre?
1602.
He said that there were, and I remember when I first read this, that there were no unnatural behaviors, and I knew he was a liar. He didn't know what the about. I was like, there's no way. But queerness has always been at the center of the decolonization movement. It unfortunately doesn't get the acknowledgement that it needs. But I'm very proud to say that queerness has always been at the center of the decolonization movement. We can even look at very recent history with OPIR and the very first delegation from Guohan that went to testify at the United Nations. Chris Paris Howard was a late elder, recently passed away, and an author was in that first delegation. And BJ Cruz, former judge, speaker, and also a public auditor, I was like, this genius gay man. He was also at the center of the decolonization movement for a while. A human rights attorney, and author and poet, Julian Uggen. So a lot more queer men. Unfortunately, though, it hasn't been said like explicitly as it should always have been, like queerness is so critical really to the movement and to resistance. And I myself, as a queer Chamorro person, I can say that sometimes it does still feel lonely in the movement space, because it's there, but it's not, you know, like our magic is always being used to Maget, but oh no, just kidding. All right, right, Maget, our magic's always being used. So I'm just kidding. But colonization has definitely impacted, you know, our knowledge of our queer ancestors. And so that's something that a lot of younger queer activists, artists are trying to re-envision and reclaim. There's been a beautiful, I actually wanted to get up. I was wondering if I could go to my bookshelf, but there's been a beautiful, during at the beginning of the pandemic, this group of queer Chamorro artists, a creative collective called Gumagela, mm-hmm. did this call for a zine, and it was very far reaching, and it really brought together queer Chamorro creatives from Guohan and the diaspora in a very first collection of Chamorro queer art and writing about queer love and sex specifically. And it's a beautiful project. I think you can still find the digital issue, but I would suggest following them. But in terms of like, we definitely need to do, there needs to be a lot more, you know, research, formal scholarship, in looking in the ways that missionization, the violent missionization, which it was the Jesuits. So they were also very militarized. So it's very interesting that the missionization is also a militarized missionization. It's very early on of Guohan. So the ways that queerness is erased already, you know, even in the Fray Juan Pobre writing, we need to challenge that. But of course, finding... I can't stand it when people are like, try to accuse us that we're sort of putting present history on our past. That's ridiculous. You know, there's just so many like Chamorro queer, like Guohan is really queer. Guohan is so queer. But I was just telling some young queer folks yesterday, I went to a queer wedding. It was beautiful. I was just telling some young queer folks yesterday, like living in Guohan now is so different from growing up in Guohan in the 90s and the 80s. And, you know, it's different now. And it's still dangerous. It can still be dangerous for young queer folks and trans folks. So, we still have a lot to go. I hope I can go on and on about queerness. Mm-hmm. That actually wanted to talk about it in my presentation, but so I'm so happy you asked this question. Because I was gonna, I actually meant to talk about it in my presentation. Maget, do you wanna add anything? Because Maget and I talk about this actually. Queerness in our decolonization movement.
No, just to support what Monica said, it's always been there, but going back, there's centuries of Christianization, Catholic, you know, the Catholic Church comes in, And then so, but now it's just so many, you know, Chamorro artists and so many Chamorro scholars are just kind of reminding the people that it's always been there. And then reclaiming words, reclaiming terms for queer Chamorro identity that have been negative, that have been derogatory for generations, and then just claiming that and owning it. Yeah.
Like Gela, yeah. But even some words, some Chamorro words are not non-binary, like Saina, which is like for elders, non-binary, and Putgun and Famagun for child and children is non-binary, and even Chetsetlu for sibling is non-binary. So I love that aspect, and Maget is can talk about it. But I just wanted to show you real quick. This is the Gumagela zine. So it's really amazing. So if you could get your hands on this, I would really, I really recommend it. And then also some ancient, some Maget and I were talking about this once, ancient houses where men would go for training. And there's definitely, reading some of the history, definitely evidence of some love between the men. And there is a house, there's a woman's house. So, you know, it happened there too. Some love between the women, you know, I mean, men would practice on each other, like their love poems on each other, you know, their moves on each other so that they could try them out outside of the men's house. So anyhow, yeah, we know it's there. But Catholicism, it in the 80s and the 90s, it was still very, such a little conservative. And then, yeah, it's still kind of a conservative place. It is tough to live here, I would say. It can be really hard as a queer Indigenous person here. Yeah.
Awesome. Thanks, y'all, for that. Queerness in Guahan, in the Mariana Islands.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.